Mungo and his family.
I think also we just had to happen to enter a lot of people's inboxes who we found, and they were like incredibly generous in their responses. So
good to know he's still alive, actually, Mungo.
He was really great. But even someone like who maybe we don't know, someone like Mary Jane Case, who we certainly didn't know, an American, but we found her name, we found her on the internet, we emailed her explaining that we had this kind of crazy project, and she was very generous in her responses, and we were very lucky in that regard that when we did, as it were, track down certain people, they were very willing, a couple of exceptions, no, but for reasons we understand, but really happy to share their stories, and that then led us to other people, and it kind of worked in that way in terms of thinking about sources. It wasn't that we had a great plan and followed it rigorously, but, you know, we kind of we're very lucky in many regards in that sense.
Well, if you read, if you look at the back of the book and see the bibliography, it is exhaustive, but you've integrated all that research into, as I say, it's a work of history, it's biography, it's literary criticism. I particularly enjoyed the works of literature that you introduced and how they, because I guess that's my particular interest, but how they illuminated the lives of people on the colony. And I, Charmian Clift's book, Peel Me a Lotus, which I've never read, I now want to read. I think that writing is extraordinary.
Well, thank you for recognising that aspect of the book, because we'd hoped that would be an appealing aspect rather than a confusing aspect. So
No. When it's so well integrated into the stories that you tell.
I think it's fair to say, though, that in case we didn't actually know what we were doing a lot of the time.
I'm very pleased to hear that.
It was kind of a process of, because we knew we weren't writing biography.
Yeah.
It wasn't that, and until we came across this notion of prosopography, we were calling it a social history. I think we still use that phrase in the book as well. Just trying to recreate something of that experience and trying to convey both what it meant on a day-to-day basis, but what it meant in terms of people's developing careers as writers or artists as well. And we went and saw a film yesterday afternoon, which I can recommend to any of you who are interested in Leonard Cohen and Marion Island. It had its first showing in Perth yesterday. It's called Marion and Leonard, Words of Love. And it's basically the story of their relationship and how it developed and played out over the course of their lives, but focused on the Eadry years. But what explored in the film was the way that experience, that kind of experience of living in a fairly intense, social, highly sociable bohemian enclave, what that does to people in terms of creating conditions that are ideal for some of them to work in and conditions that are totally destructive of others. And it also hints at the sort of damage it does to people who are caught in the vortex of those creative people.
Particularly the children.
And the kind of way that plays out. Damaging.
Actually, you've got a lovely line in... it's quite late in the piece. You talk about the enforced sociability and the lack of privacy and anonymity on the island. And I'm quoting here, it was the endless meetings in cafes and bars, this enforced sociability. You describe it as a ritual that engrossed, sustained and depleted them for almost a decade. And I think that's a very succinct and incisive way of putting it.
I think that was particularly true for both George and Charmy, and they found it irresistible. I mean, they created this role for themselves as they were called the King and Queen of Eadry, and whether you got into this community, this colony, was largely whether Charmy in particular gave you the nod and said, yes, you're in. And she felt that role as being an important one to play, and she took it quite seriously, it appears, and therefore they had to be at every table. And whenever a bottle was open, they needed to be there. And whenever there was gossip and talk to be had, they wanted to be part of it. And so they were totally conflicted because they wanted to write great literature. That's what they'd gone there for. And they needed long hours to do that. They needed quiet to do that. But they couldn't find the space that they needed because these other people just gravitated around them. And they found themselves in something they both wanted, because they didn't choose to resist it either, but at the same time it was damaging their other dreams that they'd drawn them to the island initially.
They were hard workers though as well, not just Clifton Johnson but others that turned up, because they were there, many of them, to write and paint and think and those things. So the mornings, it seems, were very much taken up with that exercise, and then as soon as lunchtime came and the retsina landed on the table, then the afternoons were written off. But they were there with a purpose, very much so, and others on the island also were seeking that writerly, artistic life. So on the one hand, there was this kind of revelry down on the port, but there's also a seriousness very much to their dedication and occupation. So it's that kind of, again, that duality that they were constantly negotiating.
Well, I think the book does a great service in that respect, because the place does have that image, doesn't it, of kind of sun-drenched hedonism. And what you really tunneled into is all the work that was done by many people I'd never heard of before. So you've introduced me to some really important figures, you know, thinkers and artists that I knew nothing about. So
one of the interesting things to note too, and I think we've hopefully managed to bring this out in the book too, was the extent to which Leonard Cohen, even though he was unknown at the time, at least outside Canada, and he was there initially on the Canadian government grant to write a novel, but he'd only published a couple of volumes of poetry and he was in his mid-20s, but how he was identified by Clift, by Johnson, by several others in the community as being the one who would make his name. He was the one, Wallace said at one stage, he's destined for greatness. And it was partly to do with his work ethic, because Cohen always, till the end of his days, was a great worker. And he managed to sort of stay at the fringes of some of the worst of the socialising. And and although he was quite a heavy drug user at that stage, he probably wasn't using alcohol, which was the drug of choice of most of them. And he clearly had set himself on a path, and he was an extremely ambitious young man. And they all kind of had ambitions of a sort, but I think they picked him as the one who was most likely to kind of fulfil his destiny.
I'll just read in the preface some words from Leonard Cohen's poem or a song?
It's a song.
Which gives the book its title.
Can you play along?
Can you
sing
it? No. I've heard Paul sing. No.
If you've ever sung it, I'd probably put it on my phone.
Well, you told me there's some wonderful versions of it. Yeah.
So not Paul's, though.
It's a very beautiful song, and it's only not well known.
Can you read it?
It's probably only not well known because he never recorded it himself.
Well, it's a great poem, a great title, song, a great title.
It gave us the title of the book, and it's a song he wrote about Edra, and he wrote it quite late in his life, but it's obviously looking back on his relationship with Marion Ireland. And he writes, "The polished hill, the milky town, transparent, weightless, luminous, uncovering the two of us on that fundamental ground where love's unwilled, unleashed, unbound, and half the perfect world is found."
It's good, isn't it?
Yeah. And to us, of course, the title is suggestive of the experience of going somewhere which in so many ways is idyllic, but in so many ways is existentially challenging and debilitating.
Look, perhaps last question, because I'd like to leave time, the last four questions. Tanya, you mentioned earlier that Edra changed over that period of time and there's more influx of tourists and the film industry arrived as well. So how did that impact, how did that affect the lives of people on the island, both the visitors and the locals?
Yeah, well, the locals, you think of that time, they're coming out of two wars, so Second World War and the Greek Civil War. The island is incredibly impoverished. They have this group of people, kind of influx of people kind of moving in and out of the island. But in many ways, the Idriots welcomed the opening up of the tourism industry because they could eat and have money, and the sponge diving industry was, you know, falling away. So tourism was a new way to make money, and in many ways they welcomed that. There would be people down on the harbour, you know, spruiking for rooms with the people that were coming from elsewhere. So the people on the island, the Idriots, in many ways welcomed this boom in tourism. Clift, in particular, I think had ambivalent feelings about this at best. In many ways, in her writing, she used the tourists as a way of making the claims that she wanted to make about her presence on the island. So whereas the tourists were in flux and weren't kind of serious about being on the island, she, in that context, saw herself as having a real commitment to the island and a commitment to writing as well. So the Aegean was, as I said before, opening up to tourism, and this was something that the Greek government was orchestrating. So they were setting up Greek tourist associations which were advertising, especially in North America, to attract tourists tourists, and the island itself already had a history of tourism, so a fine arts building had already been established in the 30s where people were also coming to and from the island. There was also a very important Greek modernist painter called Gica, who was he lived in Athens, toured internationally, showed his work internationally, but he also had a house on the island as well, and it was through his house, through the British Council, that a lot of artists and writers, particularly English artists and writers, were making their way to the island, and it was in Geeker's house where Sidney Norlin was also working, so that house was a very important one for the development of the artistic community on Idra, as well as tourism. And the tourism, I guess, shifted with both the opening up of the island in this structural way. The ferries also sped up as well, so it was a lot easier to get to Idra from Athens than it had been previously. And the island itself changed from being this kind of tiny place in the Aegean where you'd kind of hang out at Katsikas and strum your guitar at Duskos to being the kind of playground of the rich. Mm-hmm. And this changed in the sense that establishments such as a nightclub called La Gudera kind of found a home there, and part of the way in which that establishment contributed to the island life was it attracted both cinematic and other kinds of royalty. So you had Elizabeth Taylor turning up. Sophia Loren turning up, who was on the island previously to make a film, which of course showed Idra in full kind of cinematic glory to the world in all this kind of colourful representations. So there were all these different things going on that really saw the island change from a kind of a bit of backwater to a place that people desired to go. And Clifton Johnson very much saw that change. They were there seeing it from the moment when the film crews first basically turned up to Idra to the point where they just felt that their home, and that's how they like to think of it, was being overrun by tourists.
Okay. Look, we might leave it there, thank you, and leave time for questions from the audience, please.
Just to follow up on those comments, thank you both very much. It sounds fascinating. Do we understand how the colony started? Was it Johnson and Cliff really started it, or were there people before that? And you mentioned the big houses very cheaply. Presumably that was a bit of an attraction. But how did the momentum start and then gather pace during the 50s?
I guess one thing we're interested in is that there is a popular idea that they did start the colony, and our research showed that that's not true in the sense that there were certainly non-Idriots on the island before Clifton Johnson, a small kind of community of artists that kind of the establishment of the island of the art school very much kind of was behind that to some extent. But in saying that, Clifton Johnson did take it upon themselves to welcome like-minded artistic types to the island like no one else had. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, they were very much saw themselves, and rightly so, as the centre of a colony that increased because of their hospitality and generosity towards other artists. So for all their fighting and everything else, they were also incredibly generous to a fault. They would just give their money away, they would have people stay at their house, all kinds of things. So in that sense, they did very much create that community.
Yes.
Something which is a little bit about the technical aspect of the work. So first of all, you obviously kind of thought through this idea of what genre I'll be writing in. So when I was originally hearing about this book, it seemed very much to me as that kind of writing which they call, creative nonfiction. But you obviously didn't embrace that. So did you think about that as a genre? And of course, the more it goes towards film, the more it will become creative nonfiction. So where did you draw the line? And the other question is the technology of the collaboration.
Yes.
Who wrote the first draft? Who wrote the second draft? How did you agree?
Yes. How did you divvy it up?
Well, it did take us six years, so we were very inefficient.
No, it's actually very fast. As you know, academic books don't get written.
And it's a big book.
It's a
waiting book. So, tell us about the collaboration. And we'll come back to the other question later. Yeah? Just, we're still friends, so
yeah, absolutely. We didn't write a chapter each.
No.
Tanya and I had history working together, as we've already referred to. I think if you talk to academics about collaborating together, they might say it's a good idea to agree all the terms and the conditions of the collaboration beforehand and how it's all going to function and operate, otherwise it's doomed for disaster. We never had that conversation. We just thought, here's a subject, let's do it. And as I said, we were a bit vague about what we were doing, but I think we were always confident that we'd work together comfortably, because we'd edited journals together before, we'd edited books together, we'd organised conferences, We had a history.
Sure, but writing a book together is substantially different.
In terms of the mechanics, I mean, I think we're blessed in that we both write in a reasonably consistent manner. With different chapters, we would just take the responsibility of doing the first draft, and then the drafts would just get passed back and forward any number of times. Mm-hmm. And I think any kind of differences that were there in terms of stylistic differences were sort of smoothed over in that process. Mm-hmm. And there are whole sections now, I think, you know, Tanya wrote that, I wrote that, other bits, I got no idea who wrote those 10 pages, because I know that we, you know, it's just so fragmentary in terms of what ended up on the page.
But it is stylistically very even. I mean, it is very lucid, incisive prose, and there are no bits that leap out at you thinking this is one person rather than the other. And that's quite difficult to achieve, I would think.
Well, it's always very gratifying when we hear that, because, you know, we knew that we had to somehow achieve that. Oh. It couldn't look like bits and pieces written by two hands, or it wouldn't have had the same effect, I don't think. Yeah. So it's nice to hear that.
Good. And your first question was about, did you think you were writing creative non-fiction, or did you envisage perhaps writing?
Or did you eschew it on purpose?
I don't think I ever saw it as a creative non-fiction project.
No, we were surprised when the publisher put biography on the back. Like, oh, is that what we were doing? I guess we didn't actually write to a genre. We just thought there's some stories here that we hope, that we're finding interesting, and maybe we hope other people, if they actually read the book, might also find interesting. We were kind of more pursuing those than thinking we are writing a biography, or we're writing a... We used social history because we didn't know what else to call it, really, because it was this kind of amalgam of things that, and that was, in that sense, it was deliberate. And we were thinking, we could do tourism, we wanted to do all these different things, but we didn't have a genre that we wanted to slot it into. So we're more just following, creating stories, really, than writing to a genre.
We do know this has created problems for bookshops.
Yep.
Because the first place I look, and I expect most people might look, is under biography, but then the question is, it's a biography of whom? Well, there's no kind of answer to that.
Yeah.
Some bookshops have put it, if they've got a section they call Australian Studies or something, it's ended up in there. Readings in Melbourne put it under Cultural Studies, which I don't think it's a Cultural Studies book. I'm sure Krishna would tell us it's not Cultural Studies. Dimmicks in Melbourne put it under Music.
Oh, really?
Only
you're thinking Leonard.
Does it come with an audio
tape
as well?
Yeah.
Seriously, under Music.
So I think for browsing purposes, it's not easy to place in a bookshop.
Well, structurally, it's interesting too, because it's not chronological.
That was deliberate.
Yeah. So
that was the one decision.
It goes backwards and forwards in time. Mm. So tell us about that how you organised it, because some chapters are, if you like, thematic, some are historical, some are focused on an individual or place. There's wonderful descriptions of place. So how did it all come together, this... You just pull it out. let's put a chapter on.
Well, actually, we did, in a way. I guess the one decision we made that was conscious, if it wasn't writing to creative nonfiction, it was about the structure. Very early on, for reasons I'm not sure I can consciously explain, we did decide that we didn't want it to be chronological. And I think that was because that the stories themselves did interleave. And that also, I don't know, it just didn't seem to be a story that... I think it would be dull if it went from in 1955, these people turned up and then they left in 1964.
Yeah.
It was all the kind of swirlingness that we wanted to kind of try and capture in the narrative as well, which, you know, in some ways registered the diversity and complications and contestations that the community was involved with. So in that sense, I mean, we did think, you know, places seemed to be a good thing to do given the island and that...
Yeah.
The people we're very much located, like we're very interested in that idea of locatedness and the importance of that for shaping the story. But we certainly didn't want it to be about a chapter on Cohen or a chapter on Clifton Johnson. We didn't. Yeah.
I like that metaphor of swirling.
Yeah, that's kind of how we.
And when I move from one chapter to the next, there is that sense of unexpectedness. You're not quite sure what's going to happen next. And I like that. That's a really pleasurable reading experience. Yeah.
Yeah, so we like that kind of notion that some people would crop up in one chapter and then they'd disappear and then reappear in another chapter somewhere else in a slightly different context. I mean, we did have to, though, kind of honour chronology to the point of view that we, because we bounded it by those 9 years, 55 to 64... Yeah. We do start in 1955 with the arrival of Clifton Johnson on the island, saying this was a transitional moment in the development of that colony, and then finish in 64 when they leave the island, because although there's still an artistic community there on Idra, which is sort of descendant from these people in a very direct way, at least in its initial form, it had run its course by 1964 when they left the island, that their impact had significantly waned, that there was a new atmospherics around the island for reasons that Tanya explained, and it was moving into a different period quite clearly. So we did want to start and finish with those two dates, but in between we just kind of let the narrative take its own course.
So when you start with them, may I just read out a section? So I think this is wonderful. It's a very short piece about their relationship. So it's page 53, so it's quite early in the piece. So Johnston and Clift's relationship and marriage had been grounded not only in an immediate personal attraction, but also in a mutual recognition of each other's emotional fragility. The couple instinctively knew how and how easily they could hurt and wound each other. They were both given to great passions and intense emotional responses, and with scant tolerance for indifference in themselves or others, there was little scope for compromise in their relationship. And I really love the placement of that, because it's almost like a kind of chorus in a Greek tragedy. It's sort of foretelling the doom. So we know the story already, and so what matters is not what happens, but how it happens. I think that's really the placement of those details is wonderful. Yeah.
I think we were conscious, perhaps, in writing that we knew a lot of people who would want to read this book actually knew the story of Clifton Johnson already and how it plays out. Yeah. So there's no point keeping a surprise to the last chapter.
No.
But thank you for the placement's
just right.
Yeah. I remember actually that was a fairly late insertion into the manuscript, that section, because I think we just felt there was a gap right at that point where we needed to say something that focused right on the intensity of their relationship and how ill-equipped these people were to live in close proximity for 10 years, where they basically spent 24/7 in each other's company.
Yeah. Couldn't swim to the mainland. That must have felt like it. So any other questions, please?
Going back to 1935, imagine Rottnest, 3 hours from Perth, no electricity, no fresh water. So what do they drink? If it's coming in 3 hours, it's going to be totally expensive. These people don't necessarily have much money. There might be fish, probably no meat, no milk. So could you take us back to that time, how they... Okay, it's an idyllic place, but you've got all these obstacles.
Yeah.
Could you take us back to perhaps that setting?
Yes. Interestingly, the name Hydra comes from the Greek word for water, and it used to be a well-watered island, but it had a major earthquake in the 17th century which shut off all the wells, and most of the houses still had wells, but a lot of them had gone brackish and could no longer be used or just didn't give water at all. They used to collect water, as many of the houses on the island still do, into what they called sternas or cisterns, which were built into the house, so they'd collect all the rainwater. And because most of the rain falls within about 3 or 4 months of the year, you had to collect as much water as you could. They did still have an area of town called the Kalabagadia, which is this sweet wells. And there were two wells which are still used today, which have good drinking water in it. But there was a donkey man, and they've got a couple of photographs of the donkey man in the book, carrying the water down to the houses. Because one thing we haven't yet said about Idra, for those who are not familiar with this part of the island, it doesn't have any... There's no wheeled traffic allowed. There's no bikes, there's no trucks, there's no cars, there's nothing. everything that gets transported on the island gets transported on the back of donkeys and mules. So the donkey man brought the water. These two also bring water in and freeze. They had an ice works in the town, and there are also pictures of, in the book, of people dragging huge blocks of ice. And Charmian Cliff writes in Peel Me Lotus of George having to race down and try and get the first ice of the day, because once it's gone, there's no more for many hours. Of course, making ice from the island was hard because they didn't have electricity except for one generator which ran for very short hours. Mm. So, you know, it's constantly challenging just to kind of keep yourself washed and clean. And in fact, a lot of Peel Me Lotus is given over to kind of a quasi-renovation of the bathroom that was going on in the house as they tried to get running water in there. Mm. We have been to the house, and the first thing the owner showed us was the toilet, because he said, this is the toilet that we read so much about.
Importantly, though, the wine boat made its way to the island. The big kind of animal skins full of wine that they'd siphon off and take back to the bar. So there was kind of, it would be, I think it would be a, we wouldn't want to give the misimpression that it was isolated. In many ways, it's an island, and it's got this ship culture around it, and Spetse was next door, and so people with boats could travel. It's more that the expats, particularly Clifton Johnson, felt isolated. There was very much a community of islands, and that, you know, there was the facility to travel in that sense, but Clifton Johnson's experience was not of that time. You know, they went to Athens, Johnson was very sick, and TB, so he was often, when they did travel, it was to for him to go to Athens to see the doctor. So there was definitely that contact, but, you know, there was that sense of isolation as well, and not a lot of variety in food, and, you know, as I said before, lentils, and because the island doesn't sustain agriculture. So it was, it's very much dependent, really, on that contact with other places to get the food and water and wine.
Thank you. Any more questions? Okay, thank you. Well, please thank Paul and Tanya.
Thank you, Susan, for leading the conversation.
Pleasure.
I just wanted to finish, if I may, by noting that we mentioned a few times how we had a lot of help from